Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, alumni, and adjuncts. The recording you're about to hear is from the 2024 Bendigo Writers' Festival. I was fortunate to be the co-curator of the Bendigo Writers' Festival in 2024, programming a suite of sessions under the La Trobe Presents banner. The festival took place on the second weekend of August on the unceded country of the Djadjawurrung and Tungurung peoples of the Kulin Nation. Writing is often portrayed as a lonely, isolated pursuit. But what happens when two people write together, collaborate together on storytelling, or trying to save the world? In this event, we hear from three pairs of authors, Thomas Mayo and Kerry O'Brien, Bruce Pascoe and Lynn Harwood, and La Trobe's Dr. Taryn Phillips and Edward Narayan, who discuss the benefits they found working together with Chair La Trobe's Dr. Kelly Gardner. Please note, some of these live events may contain strong language. I hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Bendigo Writers' Festival, the final day of this fantastic festival. Thank you for coming out on a crisp, got to say, spring morning, even though it's technically not spring. My name's Kelly Gardner, and I'm a writer, and I taught writing at La Trobe for many years. And I'd like to thank La Trobe for supporting this session. We're on Djadjawurrung country here, and I'd like to acknowledge Djadjawurrung as traditional owners of this country, acknowledge their elders, past and present. This is storied land, and it was never ceded. I'd like to also acknowledge their storytellers and all First Nations storytellers with us this weekend, including some esteemed members of this panel. Before I introduce everyone up here with me, this is a world record size panel. We almost had two dogs with us as well. So I'm sad about that, actually, because that would have made us nine, which I reckon would have gone down in history. Today we're talking about collaboration, which is why it's such a big panel, because we have three pairs of people who have contributed or collaborated on books together. Writing is often portrayed as a lonely pursuit. The writer sits at their desk with notebook or laptop, hopefully writing, but sometimes staring out into middle distance or suddenly deciding to clean out the kitchen cupboards. But it's not always like that. So today we're talking about writing together, different ways of collaborating on storytelling and on trying to change the world, or at least help us understand it a little better. So to help us do that, we have a stellar panel. Start down this. Bruce Pascoe is a novelist, editor, and a farmer. Perhaps best known for his work, Dark Emu, by all means. Applaud. Dark Emu, Aboriginal Australia and the Birth of Agriculture, which changed the way many of us see and understand country and Indigenous knowledges. His latest book is a personal reflection on life, country, and the aftermath of Dark Emu. It's called Black Dark. And it was co-authored with Lynn Harwood, who also contributed the illustrations and photographs. For many years, Lynn co-edited the influential Australian short stories with Bruce, and we'll talk about that perhaps a little later as well. She's worked as a teacher, a dancer, and an artist. Taryn Phillips, next to them, is a medical anthropologist, writer and associate professor in crime, justice and legal studies in the Department of Social Inquiry at La Trobe. She is the co-author of the novel Sugar with her husband, Edward Narayan. Edward is a Fijian political analyst, researcher and writer whose work regularly appears in the Fiji Times and Fiji Sun. He is also a senior advisor with the Fiji Labour Party. Many of you will remember, I'm sure, an evening panel a few years ago over in the Alumbra when Thomas Mayo recited the Uluru Statement from the heart, by heart, from his heart to ours. Oh, I'm going to cry just thinking about it. It was one of the most memorable moments at this festival or any other. Thomas is a signatory to the Uluru Statement and has been a leading campaigner for his proposals, for its proposals for a voice to Parliament and a Makarrata Commission. He's the author of 7 books, including The Voice to Parliament, which he co-wrote with Kerry O'Brien. Kerry was a member of the eminent panel advising the Queensland Government on a path to treaty. Kerry is one of this country's leading journalists. He reported for This Day Tonight and Four Corners, presented Late Line for 6 years, 7:30 for 15 years, and Four Corners for 5. He's won 6 Walkley Awards, including the Gold Walkley, and captured that career and life in a memoir, which is, of course, available in the bookshop, as are all of these books. And the authors will be signing books after the session downstairs if you'd like to join us. So please welcome our panel. So let's hear first how these books came about and why they became collaborations. Thomas, you write in the book that you approached Kerry to work on it together. What was that idea for the book and why was it important to have a collaborator?
Yeah, I mean, my initial idea about the book was to give people something practical to support the campaign once Labor had committed to a referendum. And partly I took on a co-author because I was running out of time and I thought, how am I going to get this done on top of running around the country, doing what I was doing? But also because I thought it was important for different perspectives, you know, a First Nations perspective, a non-Indigenous allies perspective as well. So that's why I invited Kerry and I was really excited when he said yes. And we got stuck into it. Yeah.
So, Kerry, how did you get stuck into it? How did you approach the process of working together?
Well, fundamentally, it was taken out of our hands because we had a very tight deadline. Thomas approached me in November and we started writing in December for what originally was, I think, a February deadline. It became March. But Thomas, as he said, Thomas was all over the country. We didn't at any stage. There wasn't 1 minute in the process when we were in the same room. Or even the same town, or even often the same state. Because I might ring Thomas one morning to talk about a point, and he might ring me back later that afternoon at the other end of the country from where he'd been in the morning. So Thomas was fitting his writing in while literally running around the entire country, and he was using every means of transport other than a push bike because one day he'd be in a car driving from Orange to Canberra and the next day he'd be in an airport in Adelaide or somewhere. And we had Bernadette Foley. So Thomas was all over the place. I was sitting up in my home in the Northern Rivers, and Bernadette Foley, who was our extraordinarily good and ever-patient editor, she was in Sydney. So three of us, because she was key to the whole thing. And she'd worked with Thomas a lot, so she was able to fill me in on his idiosyncrasies as we went along.
Uh-oh.
The important thing for us, I think, Thomas, was getting the structure right. And once we had the structure right and we worked out what made sense for each of us to write, it wasn't like we would each work together page by page by page. I would be working on one chapter while Thomas would be working on another.
Yeah.
And we'd collaborate on each other's work and we'd each read the other's work and we'd have suggestions and so on. But it worked really amazingly well. I've done a lot of collaborating working in current affairs television is a very collegiate process, but usually you're in the same place. Yeah.
Thank you. Taryn, you describe Sugar as an ethnographic novel. Can you tell us a little bit more about that approach?
Yeah, so I'm an anthropologist, and an ethnographic novel is a story that is somewhat fictional, but it's based on interviews and participant observation and long-term research and lived experience. So when we started writing our book, we actually just wanted to write a good story, partly to get students reading again, that also is based on many years of research that I've done in Fiji and Eddie's background as a grandchild of indentured labourers, which Eddie can talk more about.
Yes, yeah, so the book Sugar is based in Fiji and I'm from Fiji, and Taryn started writing the book, and she was always kind of referring to me for cultural references, and then I kind of wrangled my way into the writing process. So the ethnographic thing is the fact that, because it's based in Fiji and it's about the Fijian people and it's a representation of who and what they are, there's fact, but it's also a novel, it's a murder mystery, so there's this fiction, and intertwining the blurred lines between fact and fiction, I suppose, is described as an ethnographic novel.
Yeah. So where did the story start for you? What was it, a character or idea or the idea of the crime? Or
Taz came up with a story. I mean, she had all sorts of stories going on. There's a Nigerian gangster in Switzerland at one point. But then it became a murder mystery in Fiji. And then it's like, oh, you know, she'd read me things, and I'd be like, oh, no, that wouldn't happen. They wouldn't think that way,
okay,
et cetera. And then we started collaborating
Bruce, you've had such an impact on so many of our cultures, written so much, ranged over so much country and so many issues in your fiction and non-fiction. Why did you feel that it was time to write the story of your place and its people over that particular year?
I didn't. That was Sally Heath's idea, the publisher, and she asked us, would we do it? And we were prevaricating for a while because we had a lot of other work on. But then the more we talked about it, the more you could see how it would work. And you could see how Lynn's photos and drawings would be a feature of it. And we actually enjoyed the process enormously and now miss it.
Yeah.
It was very relaxing, is not the word to use, but it was a wonderful thing to do, and it made us concentrate more on country. I didn't think that was going to be possible, but it actually did, because we knew we were going to have to write about it that night, so you pay more attention.
And so you were reflecting on your... It's like a diary, in a way, you reflecting on things you've been thinking on during the day and having to actually put them into words.
Yeah, well, it was real diary entries, not every day, but most days, depending on whether we were travelling or not. And, you know, it taught us a bit about our country, and like I said, I didn't think that was going to be possible, but just concentrating on it so intensely, and then reviewing that, what we'd already written, was very productive.
Mm. Thank you. And Lynn, your images and your photos and drawings tell their own story, don't they, within the text. How did you two work together to create the book?
So it was literally a diary. So every day, or most days, we would put something in the diary about, you know, what we'd observed, what you know, walking about, driving about, whatever, observations of our country. And I think I sort of realised in the end that Bruce would probably put it all together after we'd decided on a structure. But I did try in my diarising to use good language, I suppose. So the observations are there, but I really did try to do my best in describing what I saw. So the images came out of those animals, basically, the drawings in particular, those animals that are important to us on country. So Birrandurrandurran, the spurwing plover, Galu, the heron, Bunjil. These are Merigar, the dingo. These are all really important in the story of our country. They connect with strong stories in the book. And of course, Umbara, the black duck, which the book is named after. So Umbara got to go on the front cover. Yeah, it tried to encapsulate those things that were really the focus of animals on country.
Mm, thank you. So these are very different books, I'm sure you can understand, but they have several things in common besides having two creators. They focus in different ways on the aftermath and ongoing processes of colonisation. They raise questions about how we want the future to be. They are about communities and culture, and they're also about pain and the possibility of healing, again, in different ways. So a question for all of you then, does collaborating, and Thomas, you kind of picked up on this, does it feel like a conscious choice of how to work with some of those questions? Might it be even a subversive way of creating art or a community way of creating work?
Yeah, I think I was thinking about this earlier. I think everything we do is sort of collaborative, right? None of us are truly individuals, and we're all shaped by, you know, the things that we experience. You know, reading Bruce's book was something pretty special to me as well, you know, and the Uluru Statement from the Heart, I was thinking about that. That's a collaboration of, you know, almost 300 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So I think every piece is somewhat that, but the conscious decision about who you work with, you know, that's when you're really focusing down on how you want to, you know, I think everything I do is to try and teach people something and how you want to move them and what particular goal you have, so, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Bruce, what are your thoughts about that, you choosing to write collaboratively? Because you've done it quite a few times, haven't you?
Yeah, I normally don't play well with other children. So, and I'm very particular about sentence structure and paragraph structure, you know, hopefully chapter structure as well. And I'm, you know, I don't like that being mucked around. But, you know, obviously collaborating with Lynn was, because we don't need to talk to each other half the time to understand what our reaction is. You know, I think of that, we had a cicada bird arrive last summer. Never seen one before, not in that country. So we were entranced by this visit from this bird. And we tracked it for days and eventually found it. But the day we found it, we never said anything to each other, because we were concentrating so much on the bird. But that part of the book, we mention it in the book, and that part wrote itself. You know, the bird wrote that.
Yeah.
But when I think of collaboration, I think of the Uluru Statement. I think that is probably the most beautifully written passage in Australian literature. And I know a lot of the people who were around at its creation, and I don't know. I still don't know who wrote it, because the likely suspects aren't saying. But the thing about it was, it might have had a lot of people contributing to it, but there's only one writer there. Eventually, it's not a, because writing by committee is awful. Yeah, you end up with a, you know, something like the instructions for a refrigerator. take part A. But, you know, the Uluru Statement is beautifully written. I've got a few ideas about who would have been the writer, but it's seamless. You know, you can see that no committee member said, oh, no, you've got to put this clause in here, because mm-hmm. that completely stuffs the ballot. See, look at Thomas.
He's not saying anything, but he's thinking hard.
Look. That's a knowing look.
No,
anyway, it's been done collaboratively, and it's going to be Australia's anthem, and it's going to be recognised around the world as a statement of country. It's not a political statement. It's an offer of love. And, you know, we'll learn to have that tacked onto the front of everyone's front door, you know. Mm. This is what we believe.
Yeah, it's such a travesty that during the campaign they said it was a declaration of war and it was part of the disinformation. Anyone that reads it could see otherwise. Totally agree with you, Bruce. I just wanted to add a little thing about the Uluru Statement. If you look at it, the proper wording and everything, where the italics, there's parts of it that are in italic that are actually from other speeches from various people throughout history. So it's collaborative in that way as well.
So he still hasn't said, eh?
No. He knows he's not telling us.
We were talking about William Cooper last night.
Yeah.
You know, talking about great statements, you know. William Cooper's a great Australian. When World War II was on, it was William Cooper, Victorian Aboriginal man, who walked to Canberra and demanded that the Australian Parliament take notice and take care of Jewish people in Germany. You know, we've got so many great black statesmen and women, and it's such a shame that it, you know, it wasn't accepted, but it's going to be accepted. There's a delay, you know, but it did hurt a lot of people. Mm. So, you know, it's such a beautiful thing, and it will be great for Australia. And, you know, 15 years' time, we'll be wondering what went wrong. Why did this happen? But all the old people who turned up at my joint after October, whatever it was, they just rocked up saying they wanted a cup of tea and a bit of firewood or something. They were there to talk about the referendum, one after another after another. But every one of them said, 39% is not bad. You know, we can do something with 39%.
And round it out, Bruce.
Agreed.
round it out. Make it 40.
Almost 50.
But they also reiterated that it's education. You know, if my generation, sorry for looking around like this, but my generation are going to solve this for you because we're going to die, and we're the ones who voted against it.
Yeah, well, don't go rushing into
that's
anything.
That's a cheer up for you on Sunday. Don't buy green bananas and fresh milk.
Thank you. I wanted to ask Eddie, too, about that process of collaborating on writing in an effort to make change in the world.
Yes. Well, first of all, we have to disclose that Taryn and I are married, husband and wife. So pretty much everything we do, we kind of run by each other. So when she's writing this book based in Fiji, straight away I was like, oh, you have to talk about the indentured laborers. You have to talk about the plight of the Indians, the indentured labor system following on from the transatlantic slavery system, and no one knows is pseudo-slavery. We have to put that in the book. We have to put in all the fallacies of development paradigms since the 80s that has failed in Fiji and the growing poverty. And so I had to put all my kind of political ideas and all my, you know, cultural ideas in. And, you know, but it was just a murder mystery. It's just a fiction. I was like, no, based in Fiji. We've got to talk about the coups. We've got to talk about the plight of the Indians. We've got to talk about poverty, the settlements, the slums, the privilege differential, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the collaboration. And Taz, obviously, as an anthropologist, wanted all that kind of stuff in the book as well. So we kind of interwove all the political aspects, the cultural dynamics, the political intrigue, all that stuff into a story about a murder.
And this is all happening through very interrupted conversations while children are underfoot.
Yeah.
So we'll be kind of going, how do we weave that aspect of history or inequality into this character's life? Who put that Lego there?
Yeah.
Like, Naveen, stop strangling your brother.
Like, strangling brother, that'll be... I don't know.
Yeah.
So unlike Bruce and Lynn, who didn't need to talk too much, you two were... in conversation.
We never fought, ever. Okay, maybe we fought a little bit. Actually, there's a lot of robust discussions, let's put it this way, which is something you can have with your wife, which is good for the creative process. Mm-hmm. I suppose if I was collaborating with some of our esteemed panelists, I wouldn't be so robust with my opinions. But with your wife, you can have those discussions. And
but also in anthropology, there's a bit of a dark past where it was usually old white men going into communities where it's usually brown people and then packaging up their observations for a usually quite white audience. So it's a very extractive approach to stories. I do think that... We have a kind of parallel story in our book where the young Australian volunteer Hannah is you know, coming in feeling that she has all this expertise to offer Fiji, and she goes in and she's interviewing in an informal settlement, which is kind of like a slum or a squatter settlement in Fiji. And she's talking to the character of Boo, who's lived quite a tragic life. She's had a recent amputation from diabetes. And Hannah's internal monologue is going like, ooh, what fascinating stories. I kind of can't wait to write about these and impress my boss, and this is going to be good for my career. And then over time in the book, Hannah learns, and we hope that it helps the reader to think about their place in the world. Hannah learns that actually she has a lot to learn, and actually stories are collaborative and social, like Thomas was saying. And so I think co-authorship has a particular political intervention to make as well.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, it's excruciating, that scene. Kerry, you talked before about how collaborative it is working in broadcast.
Yeah, it is collegiate, and you have to have a respect level. And in fact, you know, television is probably one of the most frustrating vehicles to work in, because there are so many links in the chain before something actually turns up on air. And so you have to have a level of trust, and if you can't have a level of trust, then you're always looking over each other's shoulders and things can go wrong. The important thing between Thomas and me, since this was a first for both of us, and we'd known each other a little bit because I'd done a couple of events with Thomas for a previous book, and we'd had one dinner. Where we talked about, in the build-up to The Voice, we talked a lot about it and how you were going to run the campaign and so on. So I guess it wasn't a complete accident that you would think of me when you rang. But nonetheless, you know, we both had to find our way with each other. These two great sets of authors, you know, their books came partly out of partnership that was already there. Mm. Ours was at the very beginning, and we had this clock ticking the whole time. We also had to, the tricky part, overall, was that we were bringing our book out as a handbook for the Voice campaign, not knowing for sure exactly what the campaign was going to be based on. The form of words for the referendum hadn't been determined.
Yeah.
We were fortunate to this degree that Thomas was actually on the Indigenous Committee that was putting those words together to put to the Parliament, to put to the Cabinet for its sign-off, for it then to take it to the Parliament. And as it happened, the very last day of deadline that we were able to ring out of the publishers, Hardy Grant, was the day that form of words was determined and announced by Anthony Albanese, with my collaborator Thomas standing immediately behind him. Now, Thomas was incredibly discreet in not passing on anything to me of what was going on inside the process. But I was able to sort of put some things together from listening very carefully to what wasn't But I think also importantly, each of us instinctively had a trust in the other. He knew where I was coming from. I knew where Thomas was coming from. I knew of his deep involvement in the process. That was incredibly important. That was fundamental to it all, obviously. That's what drove him. That's what drove the book. But to be able to, for me, to just tap into the whole process of consultation leading up to the Uluru Convention, Thomas was there every step of the way in one part of it or another, and he was able to help me get to know that. I was able to give him, from pulling out of my head, the sort of 50 years of political history around Indigenous decision-making and Indigenous policy, because I'd begun to report on Indigenous issues in the very early 70s. And so we each realised right from the start, with the time factor, that we had to be reasonably frank with each other if we thought something wasn't working in the other's work. And I don't think we ever came close to an actual argument, did we?
No, we didn't. You know, only on the stage afterwards as we were touring the country, perhaps, about when we actually started writing and everything. But I think it was, I'm very proud of what we did with this book, and that took a bit of processing for me. When the ABIAs, you know, the Industry Book Awards, when we were shortlisted for that, I was like, just not interested sort of thing, you know, like it was bittersweet sort of thing, and Kerry suggested I should go to the awards. Unfortunately, Kerry couldn't make it because he was sick, but he got Book of the Year and Social Impact Book of the Year and Nonfiction Book of the Year. And I was very proud at that point of what we did. You know, I thought, you know, the people that that purposely disinformed and confused Australians, that were working against recognition of Indigenous people, would want us to not be proud of what we did. They'd want the supporters and the volunteers not to feel like they did something important and that, you know, and to walk away and give up. And so I thought, no, you know, it's an act of defiance in itself to accept that and to hope. And that book, I think, made a great impact. But I think, you know, as far as collaboration, just to finish, Kerry and I, we really enjoyed touring together, and we did a lot of events. Yeah, it's great fun.
I learned a lot.
That work is going to live on, brother. You know, it's going to be timeless. You know, and the people who were spreading the disinformation will be down the sink, and those great statements will remain.
Yeah. Mm. Just very quickly too, we realised how important it was that everything that was in that book was beyond reproof. So, of course, on statements of opinion, then you've got to be prepared to make the arguments. But on statements of fact, we had to be absolutely accurate, because we knew. We've seen it before. We saw it in the culture wars. We saw it in the attempts, the early attempts, some of which were successful, to bring down some great historians in this country who began to write the true story of dispossession and of massacre with the colonisation process and even post-colonising, where a Keith Windschuttle might be able to find a single fact that was not necessarily germane to the premises of the book. They'd find a little fault here or there, and they would attempt to discredit the books, and they would attempt to discredit the authors through that process.
As Bruce knows all too well.
Yeah. As Bruce knows. So we were determined that no fault would be found in it, and none was.
Mm.
And I know, I can tell you, it would have been gone through with a fine tooth comb.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't have to be, but it was. Yeah, thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit about other sorts of collaborations, because as many of you have mentioned, you've worked in different ways. Most of us, as Thomas was saying, collaborate all the time with other people on projects at work, in our unions, community groups, sports teams, families. but it's not as common in writing. Still, Jeanette Winterson says books are always about other books, and so all our texts in some way are in communication with the books that came before and with the stories that came before, the country, perhaps with people that came before. And I'm conscious particularly that Lynn and Bruce collaborated for years, sustaining one of Australia's legendary literary collaborations, publishing and editing Australian short stories. So, Lynn, I'd like to ask you whether you feel that editing is a kind of collaboration, when you're editing with one another, but also is it a collaboration with the people you're editing and their words?
Look, the process was really complicated. We had, at that stage, we'd designed a house around editing Australian short stories. So we had two long lounges with a huge box in between. And inside that box were cartons full of stories. And we'd lie back on the couches, we'd pull out the stories, and most of them, or many of them, went straight to the floor. Many of them went to the right, a few went to the right. And then those few would be swapped backwards and forwards between us. And then we'd think about it, and then we'd come back together again and we'd go floor, floor, possible, floor, floor, possible. So, as I say, it was an excruciating process. We enjoyed publishing Australian short stories for many years. We hardly ever disagreed. It just, when we would come back after both reading a little pile of possibles, it was clear which ones would go in and which ones wouldn't. And rarely did we disagree, because it was just obvious. And I think we have the same, I guess, taste. So Australian short stories had a very strong sense about it. I guess the only time really that we didn't collaborate was the actual putting together of the ordering how the stories went. And Bruce used to do that because he had that kind of sensibility about rhythm and flow. And I used to get the illustrations organised and so on and so forth. So it was it was an incredibly pleasant kind of occupation. It just didn't pay very much.
Like a lot of Australian writing and publishing. Yeah, fascinating.
And Lynn didn't mention the dogs, because they were integral to the...
Did they help with the piles?
They helped by calming us down.
Yep.
They weren't very good with the piles.
It could have been worse. You could have had cats. Kerry, can I ask you, can you talk through your collaboration with Paul Keating to produce that blockbuster biography via interviews?
Right.
What was that process like with someone like that?
Extraordinarily interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it might surprise people because, as we all know, he was never backward in expressing his point of view. And he certainly hasn't lost that. But that started as a television proposition, which was that I sit down with him and record a number of hours of just face-to-face interview in a kind of... There was a sense of biography about it. It wasn't really a biography. There was no... I'm still not aware of a precedent for that. In fact, for television, certainly in this country, nothing like it before.
It was mesmerising. Do you remember? It was absolutely...
So it was 4 hours, and we recorded 16 hours to trim that back to 4 hours, so 4 one-hour interviews on the ABC. And then afterwards, neither Paul nor I were particularly fussed about the idea of a book, but we started to get inquiries about it, and so we eventually agreed that we would do it. And basically, I executed the process. I did another 16 hours of interview with him to go to, because in 16 hours, if you think about it, it covered his life. It wasn't just his time in office. It was the whole of his parliamentary career, plus the childhood growing up, childhood influences, and in that way it was biographical. And there was stuff that I very deliberately left out because I knew there was no way that I was going to be able to do value, do justice to it. Like, for instance, the media. I left the media out entirely with those television interviews. So that was one area that I went to in some detail for the book, and that was true of another a number of other areas. His prime ministership in the series was 1 hour. In the book, of course, we elaborate it much more substantially. Mabo, for instance, was incredibly important. So through that process, Paul and an agreement that I got from him in the first place, I accorded him the respect of letting him see that if I was where I was editing the book, editing the interviews down, I would show him. And I thought that given that it was in book form and so it was there in perpetuity, and where most people, if they're writing something, they have all the time in the world. You know, they have reasonable time to think through very carefully what they're saying and how they're going to express it. You do it in oral form. It's there and it's gone. And you're thinking on your feet. So I thought I owed it to him, because it was going to be in book form, to actually play with the words a little bit if he wanted to, if he felt he could improve the way he expressed them, but on the explicit understanding that he couldn't change the meaning, so that it had that integrity about it. He didn't do it much, but when he did, it was definitely an improvement. He's a beautiful writer, actually, Keating. Very good writer. And in that way, it was collaborative. He didn't complain about lines of questioning that I went down that were important as far as I was concerned. And we had this extraordinary resource, apart from all the others, which was thousands and thousands and thousands of newspaper cuttings that he'd made over the course of his career, from the beginning, virtually, which would have saved me, you know, and an extraordinary amount of research time, and some of those things I would never have got to. Anyway, so that was the nature of the collaboration. We worked very closely together, and he had that right to improve the form of expression rather than actual content.
Right, which journalists don't often give, do they? So that was very generous of you. Okay, we're going to go to audience questions. I can see the phone has been pinging away, so get them in. There's your number up there. But while I just get that organised, Thomas, I did want to ask you about, because you have also, you've collaborated, most of you have collaborated in lots of other ways, academic writing, lots of non-fiction, but I wanted to ask you about the picture book, Freedom Day, because that's a collaboration with two other people, including an illustrator, but it's told in the voice of Rosie Smiler. Could you talk a little bit about how that worked?
Yeah, so my first book in 2019 was Finding the Heart of the Nation, and Rosie Smiler is Vincent Lingiari's granddaughter, Vincent Lingiari, the leader of the Wavehill Walk-Off. And so in that interview that I did, because it's a narrative that weaves through these interviews, she said she really wanted the story of her grandfather to be told to the children. So after that, I approached Rosie and said, well, let's do what we talked about. And we wrote Freedom Day together. I think it's really important. So another book that came out in May this year with Mugabulla was Our Flag, Our Story, the Torres Strait Islander flag, because I realised during the referendum campaign, people don't know a lot about the Torres Strait. And so I invited the son of the guy that created the flag, Bernard Namok, to co-author that with me. And the reason I do that is because I just think it's so important to have a genuine partnership if I'm writing something about someone else's story. And so that's why I did that. The other book that I've got a collaboration with on is Dear Son, Letters and Reflections of First Nations Fathers and Sons, and that's an anthology of letters from fathers to sons and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And that collaboration was mainly when I started to write the advice to my own son, which was to have an open mind and consider others' perspectives. At that point, I thought, I've got to invite other men to write letters as well. Mm. So that's why I did it.
Mm. Fantastic. Thank you. Okay, we've got a million audience questions, of course, and a million people up here on stage. So if they're going to ask a question of everyone, you're going to have to keep it very brief. Yeah. This is a juicy one. What favourite and unexpected thing did you discover about your co-writers during your process of collaboration? The married couples might like to fudge their answers on this. Lynn, let's start with you.
Oh, gosh. Look, we'd been married for 35 years. Not a lot left to really. I'm in awe of Bruce's ability to write. I think he not only writes beautifully, but his voice is so large, so wide, so broad, so philosophical, historical, cultural, and so I've always known it, but certainly from the diary to the finished product, the breadth of the book just exploded.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Bruce?
Well, I suppose because we knew each other so well and, you know, we separated for 4 years, but we were still each other's best friend. But during the writing of the book, what stood out for me was Lynn's intelligence, her emotional intelligence and her steadiness. You know, because we were going through a very difficult time. The country was going through a very difficult time. And a lot of that was coming directly through our house. So there's a lot of turbulence going on. And Lynn is just rock steady on moral principles. And for me, that's an enormous reassurance because you don't want to... You know, we all need a friend.
It's so beautiful hearing you two talk about your collaboration. I think what I learned about Eddie was his... Well, again, we knew quite a lot about each other, but a really deep empathy for all of the characters in the book. So, you know, for example, we'd write about a particular group of people who we know very well in Fiji, which is a kind of group of expat women, many of whom aren't allowed to work because they're on spousal visas, so they're accompanying husbands in very important diplomatic missions. And it's very easy to kind of caricature them in a way. And so I would write a scene about these women and Eddie would say, I think we're caricaturing them a bit much. I think we're being unfair. And so he'd suggest we have to make it a bit more subtle. And he did that with so many characters in the book, such that I think it then represents the kind of richness and humanity and messiness of social life so much better than the earlier iterations. Every time we go back there, though, we always go, oh, gosh, I think we made it too subtle. But, yeah, I love that about you, Eddie.
Aww.
I wanted the wise wisdom and the... Well, Taz is a great writer, isn't it? So just to explain our collaboration, Taz wrote all the words in the book, and I was the the cultural reference and the political, the character development, the plot, and all that kind of stuff. And she's a wonderful writer, and we Lynn said, we had known each other for 15 years at least, and married for 20 years almost, married for most of that. So we knew each other very well, and we put in a cauldron, really, because, I mean, there's nothing... We're still together after that, so that's... So we learned...
Just.
Yeah, no, that's not true. That's not true at all. Anyways, yes, we learned... You know, we worked very well together, and we that kind of solidified... made me realize that definitely she's my wife, and we love each other, and we can work together under the toughest kind of circumstances, trying to do something creative... Yeah, great writer and wonderful wife. What else can I say?
Aww.
That'll give you another 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
that's not true. We've got evidence of that.
Yeah, it's on the record. That's on the record. So
yeah.
It's going to be in the podcast as well, so they'll be there.
Yeah. Kerry, what about, well, what did you discover about Thomas?
I guess Thomas and me, we were a kind of an arranged marriage. but getting to know him gradually over the period, and then even more so when we were on the road together, I mean, practically, well, it was every capital city. It was quite a few provincial places as well. He must have done a lot of washing overnight in the hotel rooms because he was always in the same outfit. and it had dawned on me to a degree when we were actually writing the book, but it was cemented when we were travelling. Thomas had, and he'll correct to give you the more precise numbers, but it was something like in the previous 6 months he'd had 3 weeks at home. Might have been longer than the previous 6 months. He'd had 3 weeks at home. And there were a lot of conversations back to Mel, his partner, and the kids, and so this was a mission for Thomas, and still is, and always will be, I'm sure. That he carried lightly, in some ways, but in other ways not. You know, I mean, all of this was coming at cost. But you know those games you play where you've got to offer one word to describe a person, my word would be calm for Thomas. There was an enormous calm in this guy all the way through the process. There was a particular calm when I would point out to him that the deadline was the next day, and he would say, oh, really, mate? Looks like a long night tonight.
Yeah, certainly Kerry was the more pedantic, more detailed guy.
The yin and the yang.
I did ride a push bike, actually, during the campaign once. It was when I was desperate because I hadn't found a washing machine for a long time. Sick of wearing the same clothes and starting to crawl on me. But, I think what I can contribute in regards to that question is, as a person that had come from Darwin, you know, sort of quickly stepping onto the national stage somewhat, people like Bruce and Kerry are like celebrities to me, you know. I still sort of kick myself that I'm sitting up here with you guys. It was great, and I continue to enjoy Kerry's love of his family and, you know, that soft side of you, mate, you know, and how he looks after his grandson, and every time we catch up, you know, he talks about all of that. And a genuine big-hearted person, Kerry is. And I just love working with you, mate.
Oh.
Loving. We're going to have a group hug when we get up. We've only got a few minutes left, but this is a good question. It's one that I've thought about a lot too. What are your differences in writing styles, and how do you manage the differences? Do you smooth them over? You were talking about this a little bit about your writing together, getting the diary into different sorts of text. Do you have different writing styles, and how do you smooth them together?
We didn't actually.
Because we should say Black Duck is told in Bruce's voice.
Voice, that's absolutely correct. So all of the original writing in the diaries was shared, you know, day by day, our own experiences, sometimes from the same incident, sometimes from completely different incidents, went in. But the voice was Bruce's. And I did... There were a few times when I had said to him, gee, Bruce, I don't think I'm here. Where am I? And so a few I's had to be changed to we's.
Doesn't play well with other children.
But I don't believe that, because one of the things that happens constantly in the book is that you are both helping other people all the time. And we should acknowledge that Bruce and Lynn were both instrumental in the defence of Mallacoota in those bushfires. Lynn was just managing everybody on the phones while the shed around her was on fire, I understand. And Bruce, of course, was out on the trucks. So I don't believe that you don't play well with other people.
I'm very precious about sentences. So, you know, we merge stuff, but we merged it in conversation. And, you know, Lynn's entry, take the when the dingo got the kangaroo, that day we both observed it. It was a really vibrant, tingling day because we saw it from dawn right through to the end of the day. And we saw different things. But eventually to tell that story, it has to be done in the one voice. But, it's my bloody pen.
So it was both things in the sentence structure you approved. Yeah, okay.
I totally concur with Bruce there. Same thing with us. I didn't want to get involved in any of the writing whatsoever, because then you have a mismatch of kind of styles and all that kind of stuff. So Taz did all the writing, all the words at Taryn's, but I was there. I'm the type of guy that's jumping up and down in front of the TV if there's any plot holes. So I was like making sure that the plot was tight, the character development. It's story about people I know in Fiji. It's about Fiji, about the cultural dynamics, and I know all that very, very well. It's something that Taryn couldn't mess with, so she left. So we had very distinct roles. But if we both kind of try to write a sentence together, I don't think that would have worked. It would have been fraught with problems.
Yeah. And your book is, you've written individual pieces together, but also, did you write the introduction? I can't remember. Or you wrote bits together.
We each wrote one.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you didn't have to worry about that so much, but you did. You were kind of workshopping, one another's work.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we would each, and again, the clock was ticking, so we'd each be working on a particular chapter, and we might wait until we'd finished the chapter before we'd send it to the other and to the editor. But each was, each one of us was getting that exchange of words at the same time, each one of the three of us, including Bernadette. And so there was a three-way process going on. But Thomas is a kind of natural, instinctive storyteller. And I'm a journalist, which also involves storytelling. But, I mean, I've been doing that for nearly 60 years now. And so Thomas's writing process has all been around books. Since he's become more and more prominent and much more active and in that kind of leadership role, he's been writing more for newspapers as well, haven't you? You've actually contributed quite a lot to magazines, newspapers, journals, whatever. But because we were doing separate chapters, and because each chapter we'd identify who wrote that chapter, so it was a natural thing. If people noticed a difference in the way each chapter was being told, they would understand why.
Yeah.
But I don't think there was no kind of clash in what we were.
No,
really.
We certainly have our distinct voices.
Yeah.
And, even if we, tried to, So that was would have been clear no matter what. I don't think we really changed a lot of each other's writing, or perhaps there were some suggestions about, what should be included and all that sort of stuff. But more so, I think, and still, since, with my new book that comes out in September, always was, always will be, the Campaign for Justice and Recognition.
Oh, look, there's one.
Kerry's continued to be a guide on that, and we've spent a bit of time on the phone going over my drafts and, working it through together as we go, yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you. I'm sorry, we've run out of time. I know I've got a million more questions here. But the authors will all be downstairs signing books later, so if you want to ask them any of those questions, then you can. Thank you all for coming along and for those questions, which were fantastic. Please join me in thanking our panel.
You've been listening to a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri country. You can find out more about the Launches at La Trobe program at the La Trobe University website.